I don't have a cigar lit in here. I've just got that Tennessee cough is what I've got. Welcome to QSO Live. I'm Ted Randall, and with me is KG4WXW.
Good evening, sir.
David is here, and we are... We're not going to do like other folks. We're not going to sit here and have all this bantering about. We're going to get right to the meat of the subject here.
That's right.
That's what we got to do. Anyways, we have a guest tonight. This is kind of an unusual situation in that this fellow sent me an email. And I guess I want to say, I'm not going to say he was upset, but he was, because I said that a G5 RV was the closest thing to a dummy load that you could get. Okay, that's what I said. I admit I said that. I have a very good friend of ours that operates on 3980, I should say, and K4YMB Cactus, who makes a routine every once in a while of coming on and testing a G5 RV to show everybody that they're not a good antenna. Okay, he does this. All right. So, anyways, we have. William Sepulveda with us, K5LN, and he is a G5 RV expert. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, he sent me an email that defined, you know, why it is that, you know, if you buy a G5 RV, that it probably isn't going to work all that well, that you've got to do it a certain way to get the thing to work right. And I'm going to welcome him on in and have him kind of share with us a little bit about his experiences and his... expertise with the G5 RV. You know, he's going to call me out tonight because I said that it was the closest thing to a dummy load. What do you think, William? I mean, how are you doing?
Just fine, Ted. I appreciate being here. And you can go by Bill. That works. And, yeah, I started with the G5 RV back in the 70s. It came about that... I think it was CQ magazine. I'm not sure, CQ or 73s. They had an article in there asking. Back then, they used to ask people for input, you know, try these different things and send us your feedback. Well, I joined in on the G5 RV, how to get it to work, feeding it with coax. Okay, and so what we did is spent a lot of time experimenting, and then the guys, we would all send our comments in, then they would sort of summarize it and then put it all together. And what we found was that there's a few little quirks in the antenna, use the kind word, but that you could get it to work very well. And there have been a lot of tests that have been made where it works out great. Mostly you got to use it with an antenna tuner. But it really works well on 20 meters on the low end, on 20 meters if you make it properly.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. What is the advantage of a G5 RV? I mean, if you were looking at antennas and say, I'm going to put something up in the backyard, and you know, you decide on a G5 RV, what's the basis for this antenna?
Okay, to me, the basis for it, it's a single wire antenna that gives you multi-band functionality. So that's why, and anybody who asks me that's new, and I say, how much space do you have? And I said, if you have 100 feet, I would recommend a G5 RV, and I'll give you the instructions on how to build it.
Now, that's a multi-band antenna, but now is that... coax fed? Are you feeding it with coax or with an antenna tuner?
Well, no. You feed it with both, to answer your question. When you make it, when the antenna is made, at least to the way my experiments have gone, if you make it to where you use the 34-foot, 450-ohm feed line, you terminate that with 75 ohms of coax. And it can be the RG59 or the RG11 style. Either one works. But it's got to be a minimum of 70 feet. More is no problem, but it's got to be a minimum of 70 feet.
70 feet of coax, you're saying?
70 feet of coax.
Now, let me ask you this question, because all the G5 RVs I fiddled with were, 35 feet or 34 feet of open wire line, and would terminate at an SO239, and I always used 50-ohm coax. Now, is that a problem for it? I mean, is that where maybe my trouble was?
Yeah, that is a problem. It works two ways. One is if you use, and don't quote me on this, it's been a long time, okay? But at the termination of the 34 feet, the impedance is about 90 ohms. So using the 75 ohms, you're a lot closer than using 50 ohms, okay? So, and it has to be 70 feet. It's got to be that. But that's the problem. If you feed the 450 ohm feed line, if you use that at 34 feet, you got to have the 75 ohm coax.
Okay. Now, and really, when you get right down to it, that is kind of an advantage if you can use the 75 ohm coax, because there's an abundance of that stuff everywhere, and you can buy it really cheap. I mean, it's like cable TV coax and all that kind of thing is all 75 ohms. So at least it used to be we could find rolls of it, you know, cheap, that people would, you know, they'd, I guess, the cable company come in, they start using it for whatever, and then maybe use half a roll, and they don't finish the roll. So, you know, your advantage to be able to get it at bargain prices, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, that and any one that you want to use, any way you can get it, you know how hams are.
Yeah, well, I remember picking up rolls of coax at a ham fest, and I thought when I bought it, it was 50 ohms, you know, and then I discovered later it's 75 ohms, and everybody acted like, wow, that's just useless. There's nothing you can do with that, you know. And I thought, okay, the cable TV people use it. Why couldn't we use it, you know? And I've used it several times where I've hooked it up and just ignored the fact it was 70 ohms. It seemed to work okay. So I don't know how. The problem we've got in amateur radio, we suffer from wives' tales on all kinds of things. Now, some of the stuff is true, some of it's not, and You just don't know. You know, you really don't know. You have to almost hands-on try it before you know for sure that it doesn't work. Well, okay, so you're saying you have to have go over 75 feet of coax, a minimum of 75 feet, and if you go shorter than that, it's not going to work so well. But 75 feet plus is fine.
Yeah, 70 feet plus is fine. Anything less than that, it's not going to work the same.
Yeah, that's you know, I'm actually I was quickly running around on the internet here looking for these magic numbers, and I'm not seeing these magic numbers anywhere. And I bet you that's why people are having all of these problems, because these numbers aren't, you know, it's not there. Everybody's calling for like 35 feet here.
35 feet of coax.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. That's just been my experience. Okay, building a lot of these, participating back in the 70s when they did this, but it had to be a minimum of 70 feet. And to some people, the 70 feet's a long distance, right? Hey, it's just coming down my window. Well, there's no problem with that, because you take a coffee can and you wrap the coax around the coffee can. Right? Lay tape on there first, roll a coax, and make an RF choke to take up the excess. It doesn't hurt anything, and it works just fine. But then you get your cable to work shorter. But and there's a lot of things to it. A lot of people don't know the criticality of that open wire feed line next to metal. Okay, some people, I've gone to their house, they said, hey, this antenna doesn't work. What the heck is going on? They use a different wording. But, So I go look at it. What do they do? They have the open wire feed line taped to the metal pole that's holding up the antenna. Okay, you gotta have that open wire feed line a minimum of 2 feet away from any metal object. Okay, and if you put it up on a pole, you can make a T-section out of PVC pipe and just clamp it to the pole and let it stick out with another T-section on the end, run the open wire feed through it down to the bottom. Just maintain that 2 foot distance from the top to the bottom, and everything works great.
The other thing, the
feed line needs to be perpendicular to the horizontal wire. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I've used an awful lot of open wire line, and I run it everywhere. I mean, I kind of ignore, keeping it safe and a distance away, but I found that the only time I've ever had any trouble with it, if it's running parallel with something metal. Perpendicular, you can run it across things and over things and all that kind of stuff, you're fine. But if it runs perpendicular for a foot or two, you have real trouble. Or I should say it runs along the sign, along with it, or, you know, in a straight line, over the top of a metal heat duct. You know, you got it sitting there and it's running in the same direction as a heat duct and it's resting on it. You got trouble. Flip it around and go perpendicular, you don't have any trouble. I don't know. I mean, that's just been what I found. I've always used open wire line to feed antennas. And, of course, I'm stuck back in the 50s because what I use is a Johnson kilowatt matchbox and open wire line, you know. So it's like having a camping refrigerator sitting on your desk because the KW matchbox, pretty good size piece of stuff there. So, but that I've always had excellent results with that, you know. But open wire has never had. A lot of people have talked about, you know, you got to be real careful. I've never been careful, so I guess I've been careful from the standpoint I've never ran it parallel with another piece of wire. I think if you had other wire near it, it's obviously gonna be you have a transformer there. So So what I guess, you know, you got on this G5 RV thing. How did you find its performance, say, on the 80-meter band?
Oh, it works great. I've had real success with it. And before when we talked about, you know, on our exchange of emails, I looked up some documents and had to read over the Varney, the actual Varney original document that he put out. Then I found some others. And LB Sibic, W4RNL, did a great write-up on it, and he draws in. He got some patterns, and on 80 meters, if you have the wire horizontal and your feed line coming down perpendicular, okay, it's almost omnidirectional on 80 meters.
I was wondering because it's a little, you know, it's shorter than, you know, a dipole at 65 feet per side. So you figure a dipole at 65 or 68 feet. I can't remember what's the number. That's total. That's what is it end to end?
What, for an 80 meter dipole?
Yeah, well, it's what is it, 68 feet per side or something?
Yeah,
like
125
that.
Feet, something like 26 feet, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, so
So
the G5 RV is almost that big. By its design. In other words, it's almost a half wave on 80 meters from end to end.
Yeah, on 80 meters, it uses part of the 450-ohm feed line as part of the antenna. Okay, that's the unique part about this antenna, that on the 80 meters, it uses part of that feed line for part of the antenna length. So it tunes up on 80 meters.
Now let me ask you a question. Is the length and everything on this thing calculated so that it winds up being resonant, like say on 10, 20, 15, 40? I mean, is that something that's in this design, or is it do you just go to those frequencies? Say you don't have an antenna tuner, you go to those frequencies. And does it naturally have a lower standing wave on those frequencies, or is the standing wave just what it is and you just live with it?
No, it's going to be way off on all the other bands. The antenna is originally designed as a 3 half wavelength, 20-meter dipole, okay, 3/2 wavelengths, fed with open wire feed line at 34 feet, and Varney had it going directly into an L match back then when he did it. And then that would feed into the transmitter. And so the thing with the coax now, that's where back in the 70s they came up with this, hey, let's feed it with coax. What does it do? What do we need? How long does it have to be? What do you have to do anything special with it? Okay, and that's where we found out that the 70 feet just works perfect at minimum. Anything longer is no problem, okay? But that's just something that the way the antenna turned. I can't tell you all the theoretical stuff. I'm sort of a nuts and bolt kind of guy. I'm not a electrical engineer where I know all this math and all this kind of stuff. So I do it from practical experience.
Well, I guess my question is how does it? I was sold the G5RV as a coax-fed antenna that operates on all the bands. It requires no tuning, and the standing wave would be below 1.5 to 1 or something like that. That's how it was sold to me. So that's why I was asking. I said, "What's that? Well, what happens? You go up to 15 meters. Does it operate up there with a low swer, or is it, or do you need an antenna tuner to go there?"
You need an antenna tuner. The only place you don't need an antenna tuner is on 20 meters, and I think on 12 meters. I think 12 meters, you can load it without an antenna tuner. You can put it in bypass and bypass the tuner. But on all the other bands, you're going to need an antenna tuner.
Oh, you know, I was wondering about that because one of the reasons why I was wondering is the antenna was designed back before the Wark band, so I didn't know how in the world what difference would there be between 15 and 17 meters and 12 meters and 30 meters and all that sort of thing. I mean, I thought, would it operate on those bands as well? So really, when you get right down to it, this requires an antenna tuner. It's not an antenna that is resonant on all the ham bands without a tuner. Is what it amounts to.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. See, that was confusing for me because I remember putting one up, and the claim that was made that it would you don't need an antenna tuner; it would operate perfectly on all the bands. And I found that not to be so. In other words, I'd look at the swer meter, and the swer way high. You know, it's like, whoo, wow. You know, you don't want to turn an amplifier on into that kind of load.
That's
so I've wondered about that, and that answers my question. See, and the other thing too is I've got a Drake, I forget which model it is, but it's the MN2000 or something. But anyways, it's an antenna tuner that terminates only into coax. It does not have a balanced output. It's just coax. I used to scratch my head thinking, where would you use this? You know, where would you use an antenna tuner that tunes coax? Didn't make sense. But anyways, seems to me, I mean, all I would do is just kind of fool the transmitter to look at 50 ohms, but it really wouldn't affect the antenna or the, the performance of the antenna. But, if you had a tuner, then what would be the, what would be the advantage of running the coax up to the 34 feet? Why would it not perform if you just came from the antenna itself direct to open wire line right straight to your tuner?
Yeah, that's the way Varney originally designed it. He designed it that way to where it would feed from the end of the 34-foot open wire feed line to directly to the back of a antenna tuner, but it had to be one. It was an L match, right? It had to be one that would feed an open wire line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And today, all the antenna tuners that you look at, they all have a toroid in there, and they have it wound with a 4-to-1 balun, right? And they got two terminals on there where you can switch over from coax to open wire feed line. Okay, and have that match to go directly out of the tuner to the open wire feed line. Okay.
So that That original design has been since departed from. Maybe that's the reason why so many people, and I've talked to a number of people that they, you know, they're convinced that a G5 RV is, you know, just not a, a low performance antenna. That's how they view it. And if that's the case, that's probably why. You know, the original design has been abandoned, and the and we've done something else with it, and then we have compromised performance.
We have done something else with it, but unfortunately, there is a way to feed it with coax, as long as you make it the right length, minimum, okay, and it'll work. And there's two versions of that, you know, and the email I sent you, I talk about the shorter feed line version, which was made with 300 ohm feed line, okay? And in that scenario, it's 29 and a half feet long for that open, for that feed line. And then you terminate it with coax, 50 ohm coax. But it, again, it has to be 70 feet minimum, or anything longer than that works just great. So you got two configurations. I built both, used both. I built a lot of them, gave them away. I said, try this, but, and then I give them the rules, right? Because a lot of people, like you did, you run it perpendicular to it. It runs across other lines and other things, but it doesn't run parallel with a piece of metal. Well, a lot of people put it up in an apex, put it up in an inverted V, which is not a problem. It works great, but they run that open wire feed line right down the side of that metal pole or down the tower. It's just got to be at least a minimum of 2 feet away from it. And then what you do is, while the line is running down, you twist it so when the wind blows, it doesn't become a sail and put extra load on the solder connections on both ends. So, and that way you get, the wind isn't a problem, but yet you're able to keep the distance away from metal, and it just loads up just great. And gets, and it puts all the power out to the antenna.
Okay. Well, if you were coming down a pole, an open wire line taped to the pole, I can't think of anybody that would do that, but I suppose somebody somewhere, that would be a, that'd be an RF transformer of some kind. I mean, the pole would interact with the line, especially if they're parallel to each other and they're, and it's running right down the side.
Oh yeah. I ran into the situation where they actually had it taped to the metal pole.
Well, you know, some time ago, I remember when I was a kid, when 300 ohm twin lead was popular, for television, they always had these little devices that they'll get a ring would slip over the mast, and it would stand that twin lead off by 8 or 9 inches, and the twin lead would go right through the little round eyelet, and it would keep that thing away from the mast going up and down. And I remember that, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't very far away that they had to get it, but they had to give it some distance away. But that frequency, who knows what the interaction is.
Yep.
Well, okay, let me ask you this.
Okay.
I guess I should ask this question first, and that is because of my comments I made on the radio here. What had you or has you so passionate about this particular antenna? Or were you just irritated at me because I said it was the closest thing to a dummy load? I mean, well, I guess I'll say, what attracted you to it? Why do you, you really are quite an expert on the G5 RV. You're telling me things I didn't know. So, I mean, I'm just curious as to how that came about.
Well, that's because I did a lot of work on it. Okay. And I, and we have found, that they work very well if they're fed right, if the distance, between the,
hello? Well, there, looks like we've lost this gentleman.
We will get him back.
Yeah, well, I hope that, I was going to say, I'm trying to figure out which way this went. This is me. This might be a charter problem, Charter Cable. What we'll do, we'll take a quick break, and we'll get back with Bill here just in a few minutes, and see if we can't get the phone call back here. As a shortwave listener, have you been wanting to get into ham radio? Well, now it's easier than ever with Ham Test Online. That's hamtestonline.com. It's a program course, and it's incredible. It leads you through step by step, and it's not boring. It's very, very easy, and you'll get that ticket in no time flat. They guarantee it. I think it's about $25 for the 2 year for the technician course, and of course it goes up from there for the different classes of license. You need Ham Test Online. It's the only way to get the ticket that's painless and will not bore you to tears and won't snow you with all sorts of terms that you don't understand. Ham Test Online. They're our friends. They're good folks. You'll be glad you went there. HamTestOnline.com. We've got some news for you folks that live in antenna-restricted areas. You know what I'm talking about. And if it's not an HOA, it's a bunch of nosy neighbors. Well, listen, we've got some news for you. It's a new antenna. It's called the Cobweb. That's right, the Cobweb. And this thing is made by MFJ. It's incredible because it's 10 through 20 meters in all the bands in between. And it goes up real easy, and guess what? It disappears. It's got a very low takeoff angle. It's an excellent antenna. You have all kinds of fun with this thing. It's called the Cobweb. Go to the MFJ website. Just Google MFJ and Google MFJ Cobweb. Go up and take a look at this. You won't believe what you see, and you know once you see it, you're going to have one. It's the Cobweb from MFJ. If you enjoy listening to shortwave at home, you'll enjoy it even more in the car. You can get away from the dull, boring AM/FM stations and listen to something really cool on shortwave in your car with Car Shortwave Radio. Their website is carshortwaveradio.com. A small, inconspicuous antenna mounts either on your trunk or on your hood, plugs into the cigarette lighter, comes in on your car radio, and you can read the frequency out on your car radio dial. You control it all with a little key fob. It's slick. It makes your car radio sound like a Wurlitzer jukebox when you're listening to WTWW. Go to carshortwaveradio.com. That's carshortwaveradio.com. Once again, go to carshortwaveradio.com, and you'll be glad that you did. As a shortwave listener, have you been wanting to get into ham radio? Well, now it's easier than ever with Ham Test Online. That's hamtestonline.com. It's a program course, and it's incredible. It leads you through step by step, and it's not boring. It's very, very easy, and you'll get that ticket in no time flat. They guarantee it. I think it's about $25 for the 2 year for the technician course, and of course it goes up from there for the different classes of license. You need Ham Test Online. It's the only way to get the ticket that's painless and will not bore you to tears and won't snow you with all sorts of terms that you don't understand. Ham Test Online. They're our friends. They're good folks. You'll be glad you went there. HamTestOnline.com. All righty. We got cut off at the pass here. This is so typical of today's internet connections, and everything is so, you know, we rely on the internet, but I'm going to tell you what, I don't consider the internet reliable myself. I don't know about you, David.
No.
I don't think it is. And it's not. It goes down all the time.
Loves to go down exactly when the moment then.
There you go. Well, we're talking to Bill, K5LN, and he was talking and we were talking and everything went away. So he's back, and let's continue. What I was going to ask you is, we talked about the beginnings of you getting involved with G5 RVs, but let me ask you this question: Did you try any other antennas? Did you build other antennas other than the G5 RV prior to messing around with it?
Well, I built antennas my whole ham career. My first antenna was a 40-meter dipole when I got my novice license in 1963, and that was my 40-meter, 15-meter antenna, obviously. And then we played a lot with, different antennas, verticals, did a lot of phasing with verticals and also with some coaxial dipoles, you know, what do they call those? The fat antennas or the, I can't remember what they're called. There's another name for it. But we played with those. We've phased them, made a phasing box, fed those together, was able to, like Bob Heil does, change his antenna direction east to west or 360 degrees. We've made a full wave 80 meter loop, which I use now. And just because I just wanted to take down all the poles around the house because, there was more metal sticking up around the house than there were trees. But now that the trees have become, a little bit more abundant, I use the trees to hold up my 80 meter loop. So, we've gone to the 80 meter loop and I use that on the lower bands. Because I'm fortunate to have a hex beam on 20 through 6 meters, which just works out great. But, we built a whole bunch of different types and experimented with them and experimented with wire beams, just using wires and playing with the spacing and just a lot of different ones over, 50 years of being a ham operator, and especially if you're active on HF, it's just something that drives you to do that until you get to the point where you find something that works, and then you stick with it from that point on.
Yeah, I guess, I've done all kind of antenna building when I was younger, and I would have to say that a good portion of the antennas I built didn't work very well. But then I didn't know much about antenna theory, and I was too young to understand what I was reading in some of the books. But there's something about it, though. You do learn from hands-on. You learn things that'll work and things that won't work. And then sometimes, hands-on, you learn things that kind of defy the laws of physics. And theoretically, they shouldn't work, but they do. That I think, is one of the most interesting things. Now, I was going to tell folks, if they want to see something, go up to your QRZ site, because you've got all kinds of things up there. And I was looking here. He's got, a little, a description up here on different things. It says, 1952, Miami, Florida, my first receiver when I was 8 years old. I was amazed at what I could hear back then and still amazed with all I can talk to today. I've been blessed and fortunate to be able to enjoy amateur radio for all these years. So what receiver is that? I'm looking at it right here on the website, QRZ. If folks want to go there and look him up, it's K5LN. Just go to QRZ.com and put in K5LN, and then you'll see all these pictures. Now what is that? What is that on the top there?
That's NC National. NC-100, I think it was made in 47. My uncle gave it to me when I was like 9 years old. My dad got me started in this stuff, and I got hooked at the age of 8 back in 1952. And he gave me a crystal radio set. You know, the one with the Galena crystal, and you got this little cat whisker, and you got to find the right spot and all that kind. Once I did that, I was hooked on radio. And then I found out my uncle was a ham operator, but they didn't live close. So anytime we got a chance and my dad was going to go over there and visit, I would tag along because I just loved to see his setup. And he had this transmitter that was homebrew, 8-foot rack, humongous power supply. What was it? A those big tubes that glowed blue and all that kind of stuff. It was just awesome. So he gave me the receiver, and I hooked it up to the metal screen. You know, back then the screens were metal. They weren't grounded to anything, so I just ran a wire from the back of the antenna terminal to that screen, and I was just in seventh heaven.
That's incredible. I was looking here at these pictures. It says here, 1965, Hialeah, Florida. Let's see here, General Ham Radio Station, a DX-60 transmitter. That's a Heath kit. And the Hallicrafters SX-71 with an external VFO. And there was something here I saw. I remember these, the Amico NuVistor Cascade preamp. How do those work? I remember seeing those, and I've often wondered if they made a huge difference or if they brought noise up right with a signal.
Well, back then, yes, to all your questions. Back then, the receivers, they lacked gain when you got above 15 meters, right? So 10 meters wouldn't come in very well. So when you put this NuVistor preamp in front of it, oh boy, it just opened up the bands, and especially worked well with the Heathkit HR10 receiver. That one really needed it bad, and just doesn't do well. But
I was going to say, I had an HR10, and it seems like on 80 and 40 it was okay, but it was pretty deaf as you went up any higher than that. And it was frustrating to me because it was so deaf. I thought, you know, it was disappointing. And that maybe mine wasn't put together right. I don't know. I thought it was, but it just seemed, the sensitivity just seemed to drop off the higher you go.
Well, that's true. That's the way that radio is designed. It doesn't have, you know, back then it was just not, it doesn't have all the amplifier stages and the gain that they have and the receivers made after that time frame. They just didn't have it. And that preamp, it just brought it to life, and just even with the noise, right? But, you know, back then it was different because we didn't have all the filtering, right?
Right.
The filtering back then was between your ears, you know?
So, yeah.
You learn how to listen, you know?
Yeah, six CW signals all coming in at the same time. You sort out the one you want to hear and focus on it.
And, that's it.
I noticed that the one picture here, it's all Heathkit. Looks like there's a Heathkit VFO for the transmitter and then the HR10. I can't make out what's in the middle, but you know that microphone you got there, that microphone in that picture, they had inverted crystals, one over the top of the other one, and they were sold, I believe it's the same one. I think Lafayette Radio sold one, Olson Electronics. Right. They were about $5, you know, and they were dual crystal. Now you see them on eBay, they want $300 for those things. I can't figure out what happened.
Well, yeah, you know what happened, but we don't have to talk about it here. In that picture in Hialeah, what's in the middle there in the brown is a speaker for the receiver, and there's just a preamps above it. Okay, so...
Those old crystal mics were made to be like a replica of the RCA 77DX, that you'd see on television and in radio stations and whatnot, but they were crystal mics, you know. And everybody accepted the fact back then that it was an economy microphone, but it worked really good on most amateur tray. You put it on a Drake TR-4C or something, it sounded great, you know. Had about the same amount of output as a D-104 because it was a dual crystal thing, you know. And but even then, I mean, they were a bargain at what they were selling for then. But then I see, and it's consistent all the way across the board. If you see them anywhere on eBay, the ticket on the price ticket on them is unbelievable in terms of what you got to pay to get one. But anyhow, today I don't think very many people would want one, you know, with the rigs we have today.
True. They're made with a different front end for the microphone input, so totally different, you know. But they still have a place. And the old stuff, you put it on a Viking Ranger, it'll drive it real well too, you know.
Yeah, well, I think any of the old tube stuff, you know, they would do fairly well, you know.
Yeah.
Now it's, you know, this is cool that you've got documentation of your your progression in ham radio. The next picture we've got here, and if folks, you go up to QRZ, you can see all these, and just put in K5LN, and that's his call sign, and these photographs will come up. You got a DX100. I'm sorry, Hot Water 100 there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was my graduation to a real radio. Before that, it was for many years since that station in Hialeah. Between there, we rented homes, and then we finally bought our home. And the one that says 1968 Southwest Miami, that's where they see the on top of the receivers, a transmitter, a homebrew, you know, made with tubes, crystals, and just the basic operations. You know, that's what I used for a long time, and it was just a blast. Then when the Heath kit came out with that HW100, it was $255 at the time. And, boy, I scraped up that money, and I grabbed one right away. And once I got that, I mean, operating transceiver, single sideband, CW with a filter, oh, it was seventh heaven.
Well, I guess I want to say if you've been running separates, then you get a transceiver. There's a little adjustment there because you're used to being able to move anywhere you want to go with either piece. And with a single transceiver without a remote VFO, you're stuck to one spot on the dial with your whatever your offset is. But the Hot Water 100 and the Hot Water 101 were history-making transceivers at the time, I think. I mean, I think they were.
I agree. They were just awesome because it was at a price range where, you know, it was affordable, at least to me.
The thing I guess I'm wondering about on this one picture. Now, is that a homebrew amplifier to the right of the Hot Water 100?
Yes. That back then, you could order the cabinets from Heathkit also. So I ordered that, and I made a amplifier, 600-watt PEP, out of four horizontal sweep tubes, okay? And I put it all in there with a fan. And I used that 80-40 and 20 meters. Okay, it worked out just super. But
you know, sweep tubes were big. I mean, there was a lot of companies. One in particular was DNA, and I think they were in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska. And I may be wrong, but anyhow, they built this whole series of linear amplifiers. Of course, they were designed for Citizens Band. You know, that was where they were marketing their things, but they were full of sweep tubes. Remember the one they called it the Phantom, and I can't remember if it had 9 or if it had 12 sweep tubes in it. It was a bunch of sweep tubes. And they were cheap back then. You could buy sweep tubes just anywhere for hardly anything. And they became very popular. Now today they're scarce. And you're going to pay for them if you can find them.
That's true.
But next to this amplifier, I can't make out what this is. It looks
that was a 6 meter. I forget what it is too, and I didn't write it down. That's my fault. I should have wrote it down. Didn't pick that up until later. But that was, I think it's an Allied 6 meter transceiver, separate transmitter, separate receiver, crystal controlled. And a lot of the folks back then would sit there with their six elements up there 50 feet and just sit there and listen to all that white noise until the band would open. And they would go nuts.
Wow. I was looking here now. I've skipped down a few pictures because you got a cabinet you've built and put everything in the cabinet and all that. But as I go down a little further, I notice there's an addition, and that is it looks like a Drake TR-3 or TR-4. And
that's an R4A.
That's an R4A, so it's not a transceiver. So did you use that in conjunction with the Heathkit as a transmitter?
No, I see that little blue box to the lower left.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know that 40 meter, that little one that was on that picture before, on top of the SX-71.
Okay.
That I converted and made a multi-band CW transmitter that ran 50 watts. Okay, so I put it in that little box. And so I use those in conjunction. And above that blue box is one of those globe VFOs.
Oh, yeah, I remember those, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what fed the transmitter. And I use the R4A in conjunction with that.
Now, let me ask you a question. Did you ever see a globe? Listen to a globe. I believe it's a Globe Scout. Globe Scout 300. Maybe it was a Globe Chief 300. Anyways, it ran 807s, I believe, in the modulator stage. It had 9909s in the final and 866A mercury vapor rectifiers. And it was VFO control. A pretty good size transmitter. It was heavy. Globe Champion. That's what it was. Champion. Globe Champion 300. Yeah, I just curious. Yeah. I had one of those. I have never ran across one since the one I had. It's amazing the stuff you get rid of that you wish you would have hung on to. You know,
but that's because nobody can pick it up anymore.
Yeah. But I would have thought by now I would have seen several of those things on eBay or something. But I haven't seen anything anywhere. So it's that's kind of strange. I see on another one here now, I do see a Heathkit. I don't know if it's a twoer or a sixer or what it is, but it's a Heathkit lunchbox. We call them lunchboxes is what we call them.
That's true. That was the only Heathkit twoer that I know of that ever did CW.
Really?
Yeah, because I modified it. I'm a CW nut. You know, Bob Heil, K9EID, he's a sideband guy. He's a phone guy. No problem. That's great. I'm just the opposite. I'm a CW nut because that's the way I was reared, and it was just something that when I learned Morse code, it taught me so much about life that I used all of that in my working career. What I learned in learning Morse code, I had to apply to my job, to what I did for the rest of my life and everything. I've just been blessed ever since.
Well, why don't you kind of explain a little bit of that? Because that sounds a little elusive to me. I mean, I can understand it being a significant thing, but how did you parallel it to life in general or life experiences?
Okay. I've taught Morse code for years. I've studied it, and what it comes down to really learn Morse code takes dedication, constant stick-to-itiveness. I don't know if that's a word, but you got to stay with it, okay, until you get it down to where it just becomes second nature, like anything else, right? Well, as I was growing up, I wasn't the brightest rock in the pile. And, you know, when I had to do something, I had to work really hard to do it. So it taught me how to work hard at doing something. And that's what went forward in every job that I did through my career. Taught me how to work hard.
Well, you know, it is a thing that you master. You know, it's not... You know, it's like you practice and you're moving around really slow. And the next thing you know, you're in the middle of QSOs with people and you're carrying on a conversation and you're not really giving it a whole lot of thought. And then all of a sudden it kind of hits you. Well, I've sort of mastered this. You know, of course, in your mind, you're thinking I should be able to go faster, should be able to copy faster. But at that point in time, there's a lot
to that part, too. And the fact that once you get to that point, it took a lot of work and a lot of constant application, a lot of constant getting on the air, a lot more than just one QSO per evening, right? It was multiple QSOs, and you keep doing that. And I think if you find any CW operator that has become proficient at it, that they're going to tell you the same thing, that they did it a lot. Okay, to where it becomes really second nature in what we call hearing the music of CW, right? Hearing the music of CW is getting up there to where you hear words being sent rather than letters. And then when you get faster, it's easier because each word winds up having a unique sound to it. And then it just starts flowing. And today, that's the problem. The methods used today, a lot of them, not all of them, a few of them have figured out that, hey, the thing is, forget this Farnsworth, forget this five-word-a-minute stuff. Jump up to 20 words a minute. You'll pick it up. Believe us, you'll pick it up. Too many people have proved this to be correct and work. And it saves you 20 years of suffering with it until you finally get up in speed. So today, the new method really is give you a little bit of application of each character sound and jump right into words and listen to the word sound, okay? And then listen to that sound at the same time that you pick up the word sound. Now let's get you on a paddle and get you sending the exact same word, but mimicking the exact sound. That way people learn how to send word sounds rather than individual letters. And when you send words, the other guy on the other end is going to love it because it's easier to hear, easier to copy.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that always frustrated me early on when attempting to learn the code was the fact that the code courses would send the characters so slow. And it was like, I thought it was confusing. It was so slow it was confusing. I mean, if you're listening to an L, you know, as an example, and they're, you know, dit, da, dit, dit, you know, that's too much for me. And my brain gets stuck somewhere, you know, gets stuck somewhere in it. But if it comes off real fast, like da, 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 dit, it's right. Easier to think L or think an L or see an L, I guess I want to say, when you hear that sound. And I've got friends of mine who say that what they do, they say that when they hear the characters coming across, in their mind, they actually see a letter and then they see a word. It's like they may see a letter at first, but then they see a word. It just kind of forms. But I think without those characters coming across fast enough as individual sounds, it's a task because the characters are so slow coming to you, your brain, you know, tends to fidget on them. I don't know if that makes any sense. You overthink, you overconcentrate, you know, and it's not the same. I think it's really difficult to learn when the letters are sent so slowly, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. You're better at
it. No, you're right. In studying this, that's why I got away from the slow stuff. And plus, it builds up plateaus and also, I call them divots, but you get in ruts, right? You can't seem to get to that other step until you spend a lot of time at it, right? And learning it at the higher speed, like 20 words a minute, gets you past all of that junk. And then you don't suffer with that. And the thing is that, once you pick that up and you feel comfortable in your skin and you feel comfortable with having a QSO on CW, and the more you have, the more it's going to be like second nature. And because you learned it at the higher speed, your proficiency increases very quickly, okay? And you're able to move up quicker in speed, proficiency, and comprehension. Because part of sending, when you practice sending, you're hearing the sound that you're sending. So if you want to do it correctly, you want to be able to send the word, da, 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 all right, so the word the, right? And you want to hear that sound. And eventually, that's what you hear. You don't hear characters anymore. You hear words. And it just, like you and I talking, right? The same thing happens. And when you increase your speed, it's just like it just flows. And that's what really makes it just a lot of fun. And it's learning a different language and being able to do something that you worked hard for. And it gives you a good feeling that you're able to do that. So a lot of head stuff goes on and learning Morse code. And also personalities play into it. Education plays into it. You know, there's a whole lot of different things that occur depending on a person's knowledge, what they learned, how to solve problems or how to learn things. It's a language that is learned different than any way people think how to solve problems. So to some people, it's a little bit more difficult to do that than it is for others. So
looking down our QS, I'm sorry, QRZ page, I'm down a little further, and now all of a sudden I see two pieces of Drake gear. So there must have been a TX4 involved there.
When we moved to Texas. Yeah, I went with, that's the Drake. That's the Drake. I'm sorry. Is that right? Yeah.
The TX4 looks like the R4. You said it was R4A, and I thought it was the TX4 probably.
But that one down there in Texas, that's the B-line, the Drake okay. B-line, the transmitter and receiver.
So you got rid of the receiver.
I got rid of that receiver. Yes. Yeah.
Well, was it a lot of difference between the R4B and the original receiver you had?
A little bit more selectivity with the R4B than the R4A. Yeah, a little bit more selectivity.
Oh, I was kind of wondering about that. But then you wound up getting a Drake transmitter too. So you had the transmitter and receiver, and this is correct. The B line.
Yes, they had the Drake R4. Transmitter and receiver. Then they had the B line, which was a TX4B, R4B. Then they had the C line, where they made more modifications in the front end and better filtering.
Well, see, I was told, I had some folks tell me that the R4B, what they felt was a better receiver than the R4C, okay? And so based on that, I went out and tried to find an R4B, and I did. I found an R4B and another TX4, or whatever, TX4B. Anyways, and then I talked to a gentleman in Ohio, and I can't recall his name, but he's an expert on Drake gear, and he says, those two receivers, he said, it would be difficult to say one's better than the other because they're apples and oranges. They're totally, totally different receivers. So now I have the both of them here. And sit them down side by side, and I find out, you know what? He's right. They are. They're completely different receivers. And there's areas I think the R4C excels in, and there's areas I think the R4B excels in. So I don't know. That's my opinion, and I could be wrong. So it doesn't take...
Well, you notice in that picture there's no microphone, right? So, but you see your Brown Brothers paddle sitting there.
There you go. I see it sitting there, and I noticed the absence of the microphone. But to the right, it looks like a little Heathkit QRP CW rig.
Yes, that was the 7, HW7 that they had. They came out with. They came out HW7, HW8, HW9. And I used that quite extensively. Because the bands were in really good shape back then, and QRP used to be lots of fun. And there's parts of the band where, you know, the QRP is more prevalent, and you can go over there and you make and everybody understands the signal's not as loud as it's going to be. So you put up with what you're hearing, and you just have fun with it.
Well, I noticed another picture here, I'm noticing that you had a Yaesu FT-757GX2, and I was going to say, I still have two, maybe three, I don't know. I always liked that radio because it was so small, you know, and it had a built-in, the ones I've got here had built-in CW filters, I don't know, but I liked them. I thought they were cool.
Yeah, it was great. I wore out the, it had QSK in it. And that was the first rig that I really had real QSK. But it was a little relay that would go. And I wore that sucker out where I couldn't use it anymore in QSK. I had to go with the semi, and it still worked great. Great little radio.
Well, I unfortunately, the first one I got was evidently had been with a and used by a CB-er, and he'd gone in there and done some hokey pokey, and it didn't work quite right. Well, the second one I got was perfect, but the first one I got, I guess he tried to operate it on 11 meters. They for a while were a very popular citizens band rig, where guys that would want to run, you know, I don't know how much power they'll run on AM, probably not a whole lot, but they were a big deal because of the VFO and being having AM on it and running AM at a particular level. I think that most of the CB operators would not be happy with it because I don't think it wouldn't run a whole lot of power on AM. On sideband,
it's only 25 watts on AM.
Yeah, on sideband it did well. Now, jumping down here, now I see another picture. You're back to separates again. Is that a DX100?
Yes.
On your table
this
there?
In the 90s, I got back into AM. Okay, I raised with CW AM, and it was a lot of fun. Plus, there were a lot of guys that were still operating AM, and a lot of good nets on 3880, and just a lot of fun. And I got that DX100 because one of the guys that was in the net with us, not a net, where we just all get together on the frequency, he got upset because I kept using that little Yaesu, right, at 757 with the 25 watts on AM. And he said, Bill, come on over. I got a transmitter for you. So he sold me that DX100.
Really?
And it was great. It was great. I lit up the whole neighborhood.
I've got two of those things here, and I haven't had the time. The reason why I have two is because I decided I was going to put one on the air, so I got the other one thinking if I need parts to make it work right, at least I've got something to rob, you know. So, anyways, I've got that sitting here. I want to get it back. I want to get it on and get it on AM. I think there's nothing. I know these guys are doing. Solid state AM rigs that are pulse width modulated and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's all cool. Matter of fact, most of the broadcast transmitters went to PDM, but I think the plate modulation just sounds better. I don't know what it is. I mean, I listen to some of these PDM transmitters playing music, and I don't think I just don't think it does it justice. A plate-modulated transmitter, I think, sounds 1,000% better as far as audio is concerned. Now, what's your take on that?
Well, I agree. I enjoy the modulation from a plate-modulated transmitter. Okay, I still have a DX60 here, the HR10, the VFO, and I've modified the thing to add push to talk and also added some more circuitry to give me a little bit more carrier power because it only runs like 22 watts on AM. But it's not plate modulated, okay? And then I have the Viking Ranger, which is plate modulated. Oh, what a difference in sound. Just fuller sound, covers the whole range. It seems like all the other ones to me that weren't plate modulated, they have their niche frequency where they really function at and not across the whole spectrum of the voice range. But I suffer with that because I have a squeaky voice. I don't have one like yours.
I don't think you have a squeaky voice at all. I was curious, though, as to how did you like the performance, though, of the DX100? I mean, as far as that's its audio that it put out on the air and so on and so forth.
Oh, I thought it was great. You know, I couldn't hear it. All I could get was reports from the other guys that told me it sounds good. Okay, and I just left it alone. I didn't do anything to it.
Oh, the D104 would probably a good match for that rig. Probably gave you a nice punchy, because that was, the D104 is a crystal. That's a crystal element in that. You could get a ceramic element, but the crystal element was really hot. And I thought the crystal element sounded better than anything back in the day, you know. But
with those transmitters, like you said earlier, those crystal elements just drove those radios just great. They got good audio at it, and it's got pretty good range for that 104.
I think a lot of that had to do with the size of the element, too, because you took that microphone apart. That was the biggest microphone element I had ever seen when I took a D-104 apart, because you take all these other mics apart, and if they have a little ceramic or even a crystal element in there, they're small. I mean, they're little.
Yeah.
And that D-104 was, like, gigantic. And I remember the guys made a big deal out of taking – you got to go in there and take the fiberglass out, because the fiberglass – it holds back the sound, you know. But then later on, someone told me the reason why the fiberglass was in there was to eliminate condensation from people who worked the microphone really close, keeping the element from getting the condensation from the person's breath on the element. So I don't know. I don't know if it was an acoustic thing, but they claimed if you took the fiberglass out or whatever it was, and their cotton or whatever they had stuffed in there, if you took it out, oh boy, it sounded a whole lot better. I don't know. So
well,
I guess
I don't either, but I still have two of them, one on the DX60, one on the Viking Ranger, and they work great. So they'll always have a place, and they also make a great lamp.
Well, you know, you got there's a picture here from 91. It says the AM operations on the bands were great, and the get together every year at, I don't know where that was, and somewhere in Texas.
Manchaca.
I wasn't going to try to say it because I figured I'd mess it up, you know. So it was you guys had just meet there. Was this kind of like a regional group, or was it a nationwide group?
Not a regional, because most of the folks were from Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, right? And it was just, you know, the guys that hung around 3880, you know, and most of them, unfortunately, are Silent Keys right now, but that was the gang, and it was awesome. And, you know, Bob has that going out there in Arkansas. He's got a group that helped him with the Pine Board Project. And they all get on there, and they have their little group. I told Bob the other day that I don't hear them. I listen for them. So we'll see what happens when the winter months come to see if the band will spread out a little bit, and we'll be able to work them in the mornings. But it's a lot. It was just tons of fun. And you sit there, right? The great part about it was you'd sit there, and all these guys would check in, right? So you do a round table, and everybody's talking about what everybody else talked about, which is sort of funny in a way, but then people would fall asleep, you know, and then it would come back to their turn, and then they'd keep calling them, and they'd never come back. It was just awesome.
I've heard on nets where people fall asleep and start snoring, and their Vox would pick them up. I was sitting there transmitting snores all night. Folks, look at QRZ, look at K5LN, go to QRZ and look at K5LN, you'll see these pictures. I see a Hammerland receiver here. To the left of that looks like a Hallicrafters, and to the right is the Johnson Viking Ranger, I do believe, but sitting in front is not just a D-104, that looks like a Turner microphone, maybe a plus two. Is that possibly what that is, or I don't know. It's blue.
Okay. To the right of the D-104,
right?
That blue one. Yeah, that's an old microphone that I picked up. Another crystal element. It was just one of those that they had back early on that just had a crystal element in it. And it just had a handle you squeeze for push to talk. And it was just because I had multiple transmitters there. I had one microphone on one microphone on the other.
And I can see as we progress down, you're starting to collect wallpaper. I notice all kinds of QSL cards on the wall. And, it's fun. That was one of the things I liked about working CW, and that was everybody on CW with QSL without any problems at all. You say QSL, it was done. They you just count on getting. And I was like crazed when I was younger. That's all I wanted to do was wallpaper the wall with QSL cards, you know. So that was the purpose of me getting on and making contacts, was to be able to get the QSL cards. And I didn't care if they were from across the street or around the world. I just wanted another piece of paper up on the wall.
Yeah, it's and you know, a lot of people get into that. That's another facet of amateur radio, right? The collecting the actual cards of the people that you talk to. And some of these guys actually write something on the back that reminds you of the QSO or what occurred at the time that you talked to the station. That's where it's really great. And they're great to have.
Well, it looks like you pretty well there kept the same batch of equipment. I don't see a whole lot of changes here.
It changes as time goes by. But, yeah, down into the, let's see, late 1994, where it says late 1994, Round Rock, Texas. If you look there, you'll see I got an Omni 6. And I figured, you know, every CW operator's got to have an Omni 6, right? So I got one. And
well, there's another Tentec rig there that is the CW only rig. I remember they put that out. What was that, the Century, or what was it called? I can't remember now.
It's to the right. It's on that same picture. It's to the right.
Right.
Century 21.
Okay, that's what it was. I know, I was figuring it was a Century, but that's only CW.
Only CW. But it tuned, they did a good marketing job because it tuned to the sideband part of the band, too. So people would tune up there and listen. You know, the people that had their novice license, they tune up there and listen, but they couldn't transmit. So it would sort of do a little bit of pushing to get them to do their upgrade. It was a great, great idea.
But you know, I remember people that had those would go up in the phone band and they would send CW up there.
Well, they could do that too. You still can, but people don't do that anymore.
Well, they did, and you'd have two guys on sideband and one guy on CW, and I'll be conversing back and forth. You know, I thought that was kind of cool, kind of a neat idea, you know, to do that. But then I noticed down here the presence of a 30L1.
Yes. That was a loaner. That was a loaner from a friend of mine. I wanted to try an amplifier. So he wasn't using it. You notice there's no cover. So he let me borrow it, and I had it for about 2 weeks just to see how it would work. And, boy, what a difference. And that's when I sent the Omni 6 back, and I got the Yaesu FT1000MP, and that was a fantastic radio. Had it for 19 years. Just a great radio.
Well, I see another Tentec piece here. Looks like, was that a Triton? I can't.
Yes.
Okay. And then above that looks like a Yaesu linear amplifier.
FL2100B linear amplifier.
Now, did that amplifier use sweep tubes as well?
No, they used that 857Bs. Is that right? No, that's not right. 572Bs.
Okay, yeah, that's
the 572Bs.
Use it's like a beefed up 811.
Yeah, well, it's the right.
But that's a big one for Heathkit. In the SB200, use that same tube.
Yes.
And SB200 was a really popular amplifier. A lot of people had those. I built a number of them.
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting to watch this though, because one thing I've noticed, you make changes, but you don't make them suddenly.
No. it takes time. You know, this whole thing with the pictures started with at the radio club here in Texas and in the area. We would get together Saturday morning, a bunch of us, have breakfast. then we'd all congregate at my house, and we'd all be about five to eight people in the shack here. And one guy would be operating the radios. Everybody else would be sitting around talking. And inevitably, somebody would ask me, "Hey, Bill, can I see your old pictures?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sure." Okay. So then one day I said, I had this thought that says, "Hey, why don't I just put this on QRZ? And that way, anybody who wants to see him can see my history, okay, of what I've gone through in amateur radio and how things have changed. And maybe it'll give them an idea to do the same thing. Start out, you know, it's all accumulative as you grow in the hobby. So that's what this turned out to be."
Well, as I go down, I see another group picture again. And then you have a – well, go ahead. Tell me about the group picture.
Okay, the group picture down there, it was a club project that I bought a NorCal Red Hot 20. It's a little QRP transceiver for 20 meters. And, it wasn't that expensive, and it just works outstanding. It's a great transmitter, a transceiver for 20 meters QRP. So I proposed this to the club, and all those people wanted to do it. So we collected the money. We ordered the kits. We met on a Saturday for, I don't know, remember how long, but lots of Saturdays. We would give them their homework assignment because the way that the instructions, you build it by section. So every week, everybody goes home and puts theirs together. We come in on Saturday and we test it. And so I had some other guys that were Elmers with me that helped in the testing. And then we got everybody either taught them how to troubleshoot to find out how it's supposed to work, explained how it was supposed to work. Great project. So it turned out to be a great project back then. Lots of camaraderie and amateur radio and just pulling people together. And then the picture below it is the one that I built, but it's been heavily modified.
Well, I was looking at another picture here that there's something under on the bottom shelf. I see two knobs, but I can't tell what it is. Maybe those are selector switches for coax or.
Give me the date. Is it January 2002?
Right.
Okay. That was my start of my antenna switch. Okay. The one on the right feeds my coax to all of the radios. Okay. So I can select whatever radio. And then the switch on the right was for my different antennas that I wanted to use. Okay. And that grew over time, and you'll see it as we go through it.
So what are you thinking about this, David? Are you watching these pictures up here?
I'm watching them, and I'm enjoying this. I mean, I'm just enjoying sitting back and listening to the descriptions of these pictures.
Well, I think it's cool, especially for younger people, to look here and see what was being used, back some time ago. I see a vertical antenna.
Yeah, that's a gap.
I was going to say, that looks pretty familiar. Yeah. How did that thing perform for you? Or do you still have it?
It worked great, but it's very top heavy. I mean, to take it down takes two people to do it. And I had it up 15 feet. And it worked really well. Very good SWR across all the bands. Forget 80 meters. Sorry to say that, but it's true. But 40 through 10 meters, it worked exceptionally well.
Now, when you say forget 80 meters, is it just too small of a profile to be real efficient on 80?
Well, yeah, that and what they did is they put a capacitor on the end of the coax inside that would give you resonance at a certain frequency within plus or minus 50 kc. Okay. And that's where you could use it. But it was a dummy load. It just didn't work.
Well, I've noticed every compact 80 meter antenna I've ever seen did not work at all. And it just, laws of physics. I mean, I say it didn't work at all. This didn't work well. But it's, you know, it's just laws of physics is all that it boils down to.
Yeah, well, that one there on this Titan, you didn't put any ground radials, right? It's all elevated, and no ground radials required based on the design of the antenna. A very interesting design. It worked well for what it was, you know, and I just used it mainly for 40 and up and at the time. Okay, and it just worked out real fine.
Well, we can move along on these
okay.
On these pictures some more, but I would like to ask you if you could kind of I mean, especially for folks that are wanting to get into CW, I was going to say, what you know, I think a lot of folks are afraid of it. They're afraid to get on. They're afraid to get on CW, and they sit there copying maybe W1AW bulletins and all that kind of stuff, but they're afraid to actually grab the key and start sending and waiting for, obviously, a reply. So what would you say to those folks? One thing we've noticed, I noticed the last article, or editorial, I should say, in QST, Tom Gallagher was talking about we're licensing a lot of new hams, but we're failing to get them on the air.
That's true.
And so let's talk CW, because I know there's guys out there that are CW fans, but I think they're afraid to grab a key and sit down and actually try their hand at getting on the air. How would you talk to them, or what would you say to them?
Well, for the folks that are experienced CW operators, there's two families, right? You got the guys that operate and ranked you, and then you got the others that are 599 thank you or contesters who have migrated to using the keyboard, the computer, the logging programs where you just push buttons. Okay, and there's a difference in copying conversation than there is to copying call signs. A lot of people can do that. I find that a lot of people are able to pick up call signs and just letters and type it in. And it's just like those guys in the military, those crypto operators that sat down there and all they did all day long was bang on those typewriters, just copying all these signals they hear. And it was a muscle memory that they got good at. And that's what happens with a lot of the people. And they get on for the contest, and that's it. Now, a lot of that has to do with, you know, the busyness of people today. A lot of people are really busy. They just don't have the time to get in there in the evening. They got a family they got to raise. They got all these other life things that get in the way of the hobby. Okay. But the thing is, if you want to do it, the same thing happens when you pick up a microphone. The first time you get your technician license and you get a handheld, You hold it in your hand, and just like Leo Laporte said when they got his license, what do I talk about? Now Leo talks on the radio on his network all day long, right? Has no problem, but here he picks up this radio and he doesn't know what to say. It's just learn, and that's the good part about getting on the air, and especially with CW, you learn processes for operating. You know, call signs, identifying at the right times, and then the CUSOs are made up in three sections: the introduction, the body of the CUSO, and then the exit of the CUSO. So, and then people got to learn how to talk, and like you, you're a great interviewer, right? They have to learn how to, every time they turn it over to the other station, you turn it over with a question. That way it shows an interest, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to find that niche that you both have, that you're both interested in, so now you can really build that relationship and you have something to talk about rather than, hey, the weather's this, the rig is this, the signal report is this, I live here, you know, and that's it, goodbye. You know, you get past that. A lot of good articles in QST that talked about at CUSO. CUSO's 101, I forget, ad-libbing there. But it was a great article talking about we need to learn how to talk more. And a lot of people don't do that much anymore. It, like Gallagher was saying, the hobby's changing. And CW requires that old-fashioned sit down and chat and rag to and always opening up the door for another question.
Well, I've got a couple questions here for newcomers getting into CW or wanting to get into it.
Okay.
Just like phone is it's easy, but it for the first time or first time around, people get mic fright and you know, they don't want to sound like a CB or they don't quite understand the lingo or the format in order, you know, how do you talk on this thing, you know. On CW, what are some of the things that are around for a while? Like, for example, when you're talking to somebody and you're wanting to indicate laughter, on CW they send hi. Okay, so what are some of the things like that, that if a newcomer is listening right now, you could talk about, and it would make them feel a little bit more comfortable fitting in, getting on CW for the first time?
Okay, there's a couple of things. Number one, if you belong to a radio club, ask the radio club to pull some CW operators together to create a class. And it also helps the folks in the club to learn how to Elmer. And that way you can sit down, feel comfortable with someone that you get to know, and they can help you through it. Now, the other way to do it is like hi and all that. They have CW abbreviations. You can find them on the internet. And they're common words that are used on CW that are sent shorter. They're abbreviated. And they have different things. You learn that. That way you can understand what's going on.
Well, the only problem with that is that, you know, I can recall a friend of mine said they went up on the internet and they grabbed a bunch of the, you know, the cue signals and all the other things, and you know, when they got on the air and started using them, you know, another ham that was overhearing the QSO and CW said, nobody does that anymore. Nobody uses that. That's not in, okay? So I guess what I was saying is, what are the in things that people do, and what are the old things? It's like, you don't ever hear anybody on phone talking and, you know, they come to the end of the sentence, hi, you know, and say hi. You don't hear much of that anymore, you know. And if you do, you might get a strange look from somebody. So I guess I was wondering, what are the abbreviations on CW that a newcomer could use without feeling awkward or trying to pick something that's, you know, that's on the internet in a list that nobody uses anymore. You know, if that makes any sense.
Well, I'm old-fashioned, so I can't help you there. All I can say is that in using CW, there's a lot of stuff that you do to expedite what's being communicated. And a lot of it is using the abbreviated words. Now, a lot of people that use keyboards today, they type everything out. But the old-timers still use the hi. But a lot of things that are changing today that I hear on sideband, a lot of the folks are using the cue signals, which are CW signals, using the cue signals to communicate verbally. So, you know, it's all on who's educating who, and I think that's it. But just another thing on the CW, and I got to put a line in here for CW Ops. The CW Ops organization has what they call CW Academy, and they teach Morse code over the internet. It's an 8-week course. You do it twice a week, and they take you from knowing nothing up to 18 words a minute, okay, by the end of the 8 weeks. And they also teach you, and this I learned also, you got to teach the people what makes up a QSO. What you talk about in the initial part of the QSO, what you talk about during the body of the CUSO, just like a letter, and then what, how you terminate a CUSO. And if you teach people that, it helps them to be a little bit more comfortable in what they're doing.
It builds their confidence up, you know, because they feel like they're not hitting it cold. They've been trained a little bit, you know.
Right. And what I do is I put out a piece of paper that gives an example on the top of two guys having a CUSO, and I go through the initial part of the CUSO with their information in the blanks. Then I have it at the bottom where they can actually print that out and put their information in there so they can actually use that to send from until they get comfortable enough to start doing it from their head.
The first time I ever saw amateur radio actually demonstrated was in Dearborn, Michigan. And the fellow's name was Nelson Cosby. David, you met him. You went with us, and he told a bunch of stories. I don't know what his call sign was. You probably could still look it up. He has since passed on. But what he did, he made it his business and every QSO to ask people some basic questions. Like he'd ask, you know, how many children do you have and how old are they? Of course, that would lead to more if the person on the other side answered, well, I've got a daughter and she's 33 or something like that. Well, she's older. So now you can ask some questions about the daughter. If they're younger kids, you can ask different questions. Then, then what he would do, he would always ask the person what their occupation was. Now, I found that to be the most interesting part of what he did because he had a log and he had written down the occupation of everyone that he had spoken to.
Right.
And that was cool, too, because if he talked to that individual again a year later, probably wouldn't remember, but he could find them in the log, and he could look down there, and he could say, ah, you know, this guy works for the state of Utah, you know, and he does whatever, you know. But he would have some reference point. The thing that...
They have that today, even in your computer logs. I use Logger 32 on mine, and it's got there for comments, right? And then you can add notes to it, which pop up every time you put that person's call sign into the entry window. And I put notes in there like, hey, good CW operator, next time we need to work at 30 words a minute, okay? And it's the great thing about when you ask, you always ask, are you working or are you retired? So you can get two different answers there. And if you find out what the work is, that just opens up a whole new window to find out what they're actually doing in the job, how long they've been working at it. And the thing, if they're retired, then that opens up a different window where you start saying, well, how long have you been retired? What kind of ham radio projects are you working on? Okay, what's your day like? How often do you operate? You know, that's another thing that I do in my training too. I give them a bunch of questions that they can ask that leads them to the other station, and it really helps. And then after a while, it sort of becomes second nature, and then you just automatically do that, and it just works out just awesome.
Well, I was going to say, because, you know, as you're asking those questions, to me, the question about the occupation to me was one of the coolest things, because as you went down his log, he had so many different kind of people doing all kinds of things, you know, you wouldn't think you'd find on ham radio, and very, very varied things. In other words, you got one guy that's a doctor, one guy's a lawyer, and one guy's a janitor, you know, and... You know, I thought that was really cool. Because you could go through the thing and you could actually see all the different kind of stuff that these people were doing for a living. And of course, if they wrote things down about their kids or their family or their wife, he would make notes of that. I guess I want to say that made it even more, interesting or intriguing. You know, wanting to talk to somebody. So that's a whole art. In itself, I guess, is what I was going to say. Well,
the art of rag chewing, right? That's the art of rag chewing.
So do you find... Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
it's like when you talk to people, and you know, I guess today it's a little bit different, but when you meet people for the first time, it's the same scenario. I mean, you know nothing about this person. Here you are looking at his face, and you forgot his name, even though he just said it 2 minutes ago, right? And so you got to learn how to be able to be open. Don't worry about it. Just ask questions and to find that niche to where you can carry on a conversation. And pretty soon maybe you'll find out that you guys are really have something really in common that you really enjoy doing. And boy, you just start off a relationship that goes forever, you know. And I've seen a lot of these. And that's another thing that's great about amateur radio. You can have relationships here, but you have relations all the way around the world.
People
that have talked to each other, become very close. They come and visit. People from Israel come here, visit, and vice versa. You know, and I just pick one place, but all over the world. And they have an opportunity to share that with each other. And
well,
that's just
one story I heard was told by Alan Pitts, who was the former publicity manager for the ARRL, and since retired. But he talked about, had a QSO with some guy overseas, and I don't remember what country it was, but it doesn't matter because the story goes like this. He's talking to this guy. They got to know each other. Then all of a sudden at Dayton, this fellow shows up. And they get to meet each other, you know, firsthand after talking for years on the radio. And, you know, I just don't know. I don't think there's any other hobby. We're told by several of our constituents, don't call it a hobby. Call it a fraternity, because that's what it is. And I happen to believe that. But there's very few, anything you could get into today where you'd have this kind of meeting new friends on the fly. I guess people do that to some degree online with chat rooms and whatnot, but it doesn't have the same warm connection as a human voice does, I don't think. And anyways, I think that's really what makes the amateur radio fraternity so unique, is the number of people that you can meet that are brand new folks. And I tell people, too, and I don't know, you tell me if you disagree. Some guys go up and down like 80 meters at night, and they'll come back and say, well, you know, I tried to check in or join a couple of these groups to start. They're not really friendly. Don't let me in. Actually, some people get harassed for jumping in and trying to become part of a group. But I tell them there's always room down the band to call CQ. Start your own group, you know.
That's true.
Just go down the dial and find you a blank spot. Ask if the frequency's in use, and then wear it out. And I don't know. That's
I found that to be true on all bands, but you know, it's just groups of people that have gotten together and they got their thing that they talk about all the time, their interests and all that. And some folks will let you come in, and some folks, you know, they're just happy to be talking with each other. And there's plenty of room, like what you said. Go call CQ and, you know, make a relationship and get back to it the next night. You know, that's what made the 80 meter AM group so great, because we were always there. Every evening we were there for a few hours, and that was awesome.
Oh, very good. Well, listen, I'm telling you something. We are just about out of time.
Yes,
so
that.
I'll ask David, is there anything that you'd like to ask or say or add to this?
You did, however, when you were going over the pictures, I was scrolling along with you guys and looking at this stuff. You did, however, you skipped right over my favorite picture of them all, and that's the shot of your workbench that you had there in Texas. That is just amazing.
Yeah.
Anybody who's a tinkerer would have loved to have that bench.
Yeah, that's still there. It's in the garage, but it gets too hot to go out there and work, so I have a small 4-foot length table here in the shack that I use to build that stuff. But yeah, that's where I work on a lot of equipment there. Hey, just one thing before I leave, and I'll let you guys go. Have your buddy that builds G5RVs to show you how they don't work. Send them my email, and tell him pay attention to the details and do that.
Okay, I'll do that. He may be listening tonight. I don't know.
I did have one other question. Did you find that the G5 RV? Did you find a sweet spot for height for it?
The higher the better.
That's
all I can say. I've only used it at 45 feet here in the house, and then at field day we launched them over trees that were 60 feet, and boy, it just worked the world. No problem using it there.
Well, the only one that we had that David would have experience with, you remember the ham antenna we put up at WJKM?
Yes.
That was a G5 RV.
Okay.
You know, and I spent most of my time swearing at it.
Yes.
And I thought, what is wrong with this?
You guys get a chance, try one. You got all the details, and give it a shot.
Well, and that is exactly what we will do. We appreciate you coming on. We're talking to Bill, K5LN, and he's the G5 RV master at this point, as far as I'm concerned. We are going to have to try it and see if we get different results, which I'm sure we will. Because you did mention the fact, too, that a lot of the G5 RVs you buy prepackaged don't take all these other things into consideration. So you may not get very good performance out of those.
That's been my observation.
Yeah, because that's what I was seeing. You know, I was jumping around on the internet trying to find those magic numbers, and I couldn't find them.
Well, you've got them.
You're
now.
You're not going to find them.
Well, thank you very much. I want to say thank you for coming on. We'll have to have you back again soon, because there's more stuff in your shack we didn't get to talk about, and other subjects about ham radio. I think you'd be a pretty good guide to. So we'll have to have you back, and I'll say 73s, and thank you so very much for joining us tonight
thank
on QSO
you,
Live.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. Thanks a lot. Have a great evening.
And 73 to everybody all the way around. I always say 73s, and I've had people correct me, but then I found a QSL card that was sent to somebody by Hiram Percy Maxim, and on that card, he signed it 73s, Hiram W1AW. So I thought, well, if he says 73s, then I've got to be able to get away with it as well, I think.
Well, I must have received the same comment from the same person, because I got the same lecture.
Oh. Well, anyways, I say 73s. To me, it just sounds better somehow. I don't know. Well, 73s, everybody, have a good night. Thank you for listening to QSO Live.
Broadcasting from near the banks of the Upper Cumberland River, this is WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, USA.